ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
ABC Cricket Podcast time with your boys, Corbin Billmass and Ed Cowan, for your Friday as the countdown is on to the start of the Adelaide Test. But before then, the Big Bash will begin, Season 15, and the WBBL season will come to a close as we crown a champion in Hobart on Saturday night. All of that ahead. This is the ABC Cricket Podcast. First of all, Ed Cowan, good afternoon to you.
Corb, I must say I've had a little Corbin Middlemass withdrawal symptoms. Hey. We had a pretty good run going on there. We had 3 days in a row in person, lots of hugs, couple of records, and then nothing. Just big withdrawal symptoms.
Cold turkey. Yep.
Yeah. Not good. Not good for the soul.
No. But here we are, ready to get into it again. Feel like I'm sort of coming down from Brisbane. They're big days, the test match days, and particularly the humidity, which I'm not totally cut out for, but I feel like I'm back. I'm well rested. I'm ready to go, and there's no shortage of talking points, as always, in the cricket landscape.
Day-night cricket takes it out of the commentary teams as well. It's hard work.
Yeah. No, there's that's for sure. Where do you want to start? Should we do the Ashes? Should we do the BBL? What do you want to kick off with?
I'm just the bloke that opens his Zoom link.
Yeah. Well, let's do the Ashes. There's a reason why it's breaking all sorts of records for a reason, and the appetite for it is enormous. So Hazelwood's out for the series. Achilles injury, Achilles tendon injury. He's played only 10 of the last 25 test matches at home. I didn't realise it was so few, to be honest. But that's not a whole lot of cricket. And now we know for sure that he obviously won't be there at any stage, even in the back end of the series. Pat Cummins, though, is in line to return. So something would have to go horribly wrong for him not to put the blazer on and toss the coin come Wednesday in Adelaide. And Nathan Lyon expected to make his return as well. So he'll be coming back. Obviously, still on 562 victims. He's bowled just 12 balls in the series so far in Australia. Obviously, 2-0 up. So that's what we seemingly know for sure. And you'd think that two of Boland, Doggett, Nisa will make way at the very least in this Australian team before we even get to the Usman Khawaja of it all.
Yeah, I think that how you've just laid it out is pretty clear cut. And I think it's pretty clear that unless injured, Scott Boland will maintain his place and the other two will make way for Lyon and Cummins. And I think the team is a stronger team, which doesn't bode well for England. I think this is a Australian team that then shapes up as we expect it to, or probably closer to how we expected it to at the start of the series. Like for like, Hazelwood and Boland, there's not too big a delta there. So look out. If you're going to have to be at the top of your game to get some runs. I guess the only thing that comes to mind when you say that is the inclusion of Nathan Lyon, I think, is a must. And Adelaide, particularly with grass on the wicket, grabs. The seam does grab and turn, and it's a great venue for him. But he would be a bowler that England would be saying, yes, we know he's great, but he is someone that we know we can take down. And particularly, 55, 60-metre boundaries in certain pockets, sometimes shorter, depending on exact dimensions. There's a world where they try and smack him out of the attack and do that quickly and risk reward, but in baseball terms, that risk payoff is probably in their favour. And I think if you're sitting in their team meeting as a fly on the wall, they're saying if Nathan Lyon comes on, we are going after him from ball one, and that's our way to getting to 400 runs. We need 125 off Nathan Lyon.
Interestingly, if you look at his graph, after reaching a high point in 2018, 2019, basically the amount of balls he's bowled in the summer has been down and to the right, basically year on year across that particular time. So that's a pretty good sample size now. We're up to six or seven summers, and he's only bowled 12 balls here. And I mean, that's the other thing. England have to actually get through the new ball and get to a stage where Nathan Lyon's actually required. Given how short some of these test matches are, they haven't really... it hasn't really lent itself for him to bowl a whole lot in those kind of circumstances as well. So, interesting stage for him. I think he's one wicket away from McGrath at this stage. So, it has a chance to try and tick off a few more boxes. But he made his thoughts known very publicly. I wonder how, one, that would play in the dressing room, and two, what that kind of means for him. Does he come out, fired up? Does he feel like he's got a point to prove? And sometimes in a sport like cricket, as we know, Teddy, it's, you know, trying harder doesn't necessarily lead to better results. And so whether, you know, it's not like a sport like football or basketball, for example, where, you know, the effort is absolutely, you know, translates into often, you know, better performance, whether what kind of psychological impact that's going to have leading into a return test match as it is now for him.
Yeah, there's a few things to unpick there. First and foremost, I think we've seen a decline in not just the overall quality in terms of consistency, but his ability to get people out. And what are the things he relies on? He relies on big revs and dip, beating people in the air, generally speaking. And those two go hand in hand. You know, the less revs you put on the ball, the less dip you get, the less you can deceive batsmen. And I think just generally at his age and stage and body, we've just seen that slowly decay, and that's not anything against Nathan Lyon. That's just human nature in many respects. So he's still Australia's best spinner. He's still a great, but I think he's definitely on the slide. Even watching him bowl in Shield cricket, he doesn't look like getting many people out. Where 10 years ago you'd put him on to bowl and no one could really play him. So that was my first point. The second point, how will he respond? I mean, interestingly, you were there when he gave the interview, I think it was on day one, and he was pretty terse, wasn't he? He was in no uncertain terms, made it pretty clear as to how annoyed, as though he feels his place in the team is slightly more secure than what it is. And then point one and two go hand in hand, by the way. I think the selectors are on to the fact that his output is declining. And so how he responds, I think he'll respond how any true sporting champion does, and it will be with gritted determination. He's not going to try any harder, but he will be out to make sure that he's focused and ready and ready to rock. So you then couple that together with my very first point was England are coming for him. He's going to be under pressure. So if you were to pinpoint one player that could be, you know, a defining character of this test, you probably do gravitate towards Nathan Lyon.
Yeah, and I'm sure he'd probably love it if they do come at him and try and take him down in that kind of fashion. Remembering too, there was absolutely a correlation, whether it was a causation or not, from the 2023 Ashes series, that when Lyon got hurt, the results for Australia dipped. And when he played, obviously Australia had success in the early part of that series. So we'll see him in Adelaide, and we'll obviously see what happens next on that front. Do I dare bring up his name, Usman Khawaja, who feels like we've spoken so much about throughout the series so far? The new information here is the press conference that was given by Andrew McDonald, obviously the senior coach and selector, who really pondered Khawaja in the middle order. So his quote reads as follows: "Us should be fit and available, and then we'll work out our batting order based on the surface and work out our bowling selections based on the surface and the opponents that we think and what they may present." Goes on to say, the assumption is that Khawaja can only open as well. He does have flexibility. We like to think that all our batters have the flexibility to be able to perform anywhere in that order. Opening, you would think, the door, or at least the pondering the possibility, could Khawaja come back in and bat in the middle order, keeping our newfound opening combination of Jake Weatherald and Travis Head intact?
I think I just spewed in my mouth. Can you make the case for me for Usman to bat in the middle order, please?
Yeah. So I would, as much as I feel, and we spoke about this on Monday, feels like this is apples and apples. Don't give me all these white ball selections and Nathan Lyon missing when it's a seamer on a pink ball game or whatever. But it's, yeah, Finch in the white ball, Warner in the test arena, and now Khawaja here. This is apples and apples. Trying to make a selection call that would ultimately end somebody's career, which is, you know, where they've had a few missteps, obviously, in the past, and clearly what Steve Waugh was referring to. But from a selector's point of view, if I was trying to rationalise where they're coming from, they could argue, if they do pick Khawaja here, it is completely consistent with their selection philosophy, which has been, we are picking the best six batters at any one time. We don't believe in batting orders, which, you know, Pat Cummins has come out and said, Travis Head's given voice to that as well. It's clearly how this selection group thinks. And so if they consider Usman Khawaja in the best six batters in the country, that if it's Inglis or Khawaja, they would rather Khawaja, regardless of spot in the lineup, which they clearly don't believe in and have proven time and time again, and maybe part of the reason why they've had such difficulty finding a long-term replacement at the top of the order, they could, I think they could make the case that would pass the pub test that he was in our six batters at the start, he's still in our six batters now, and we think he's a better option than Josh Inglis at this particular stage, which, yeah, what that says to Inglis, at some stage in the near future, they're going to have to turn to him and say, hey, mate, you're the guy. We now believe in you, even though, you know, 5 minutes ago we didn't. And so I think that you can actually rationalise, you know, where they're coming from in that point of view. It's not necessarily what I would do, but at least it's in keeping with their broader philosophy over a long period of time.
That's incredibly well articulated, and that is the case that you just put forward. So I guess the questions, if I was sitting in that meeting and that's what's presented, I'd say, when do you think he's still in the best six batters in the country? That may have been true for the record 4 weeks ago,
mm-hmm.
but I think this is an evolving feast from what we've seen of Inglis and what he contributes to the team, be it in the field, be it with the bat in the middle order, is now on a like-for-like basis Khawaja versus Inglis, who is a better person to play in that position. So there's, I guess the point I'm trying to make is when you're looking at openers, there's not just the individual, but how those two as a combination gel together. And so at that point in time, at the start of the series, it was Khawaja, the elder statesman, the narrative around he's been there, done that under pressure before. Yes, his skills are dwindling, but it's enough for some young buck to feed off, you know, in their first couple of games. That partnership is very important. Well, that's now out the window. So now it is just a pure horse race. Who do you want? Do you want Khawaja or do you want Inglis? And from all that we've seen from physical presence and ability to contribute, so rather than just down at first slip and maybe catch them, mm-hmm. to brilliant run out, so that goes into the algorithm as well.
So you're talking about a guy who's a wicketkeeper largely, that you're saying he's a better option in the field than Usman Khawaja, who Josh Inglis
I think that's an absolute no-brainer. Do you disagree with that statement?
I don't, but I don't think... it's incredible to think that the guy who ordinarily stands there with the gloves on is a better option in the field.
Yeah, but he's just more athletic.
Yeah, he's younger.
Well, we saw a game-changing... Yep. Maybe series-defining run out that was a 1 in 100 moment.
Yep.
Compared to someone that was striking at 50 or 60 with the with the hands in the previous test. So that wrapped into just physical ability to get through the test. Yes, he might be fit to bat in the nets. How fit is he to get through 5 days? The first 3 days are all what, 35, 38, 34. It's going to be hot.
I'm going
to
be
so
sweating.
Does he have that? I don't know the answer to that. All I'm saying is if I'm sitting in that room, from what I've seen over the last 3 weeks, this isn't a selection discussion. I'm not saying that they might not end up there, and I'm not saying that what you just said made sense. I just don't agree with it.
Yeah. I feel like they've kept the door open as much as they can for him, and almost the way that they picked Inglis in the team. If you pick Inglis in the team, you're basically empowering this guy. The reason he's been around the squad is because he's the reserve batsman, right? That's why he's there. He's not there to back up Alex Carey. He's there essentially to be the next best batter on call, and that's why when a spot became available in the lineup, he came in as the batsman. He got the nod over Bo Webster for that particular role. But then when they went to place him in the lineup, they put him at 7, which to me just sort of smacks a little bit of, man, you're just keeping the seat warm a little bit for us. Like, we want to put you behind Green and behind Carey, and then they gave this reason, oh, we want Green and Carey to bat together. That's fine. Put Inglis at 5. Keep Green at number 6, and there's your lineup from that particular stage. But so I don't feel like they, at least outwardly in the way it looked, it didn't scream to me of, hey, Inglis is the guy going forward, and we want him to hold down a spot in the team. It almost feels like he's in this spot for the time being, but... He's not the long-term number 7, is he? Like, it's not as if that's what the team's going to look like.
They start picking specialist batters at number 7.
So that's what I mean. So yeah, then you kind of go, well, what sort of spot's that in the lineup? Whereas if they had to put him at 5 or 6, it probably would have filled me with a bit more hope and faith in Inglis that he was going to be the guy there for at least the remainder of the series.
So you're directing traffic here. Mm. Well, I want you to be maybe driving the car a little bit. Do you believe that his spot is now not at the top of the order, given the current opening partnership?
Yes. Yeah.
And do you believe that he deserves a spot in the middle order or not?
No. I think it's the I think his performances have declined. He's in the team to open. If he's not opening, I don't think there's a place for him in my team. But if I put my finger in the wind, I feel like he's going to play and he's going to bat in the middle. That's what I think they'll do.
But imagine...
I guarantee you he won't bat at seven.
For a 39-year-old to play three test matches to potentially sign off. Like, do you see any future beyond this series for that happening?
No, it's just a straight swap head for Kawaja. They've just flipped spots in the lineup and we're back to the team that it was in the start. That's the seven.
Sometimes when you're making any kind of structural decision, you know, I'm lucky enough to work for an investment firm. It's pretty analogous actually to picking a cricket team. Like you have a set amount of people in a team like you do in a portfolio. Sometimes you get so far down decision-making processes, you actually forget what a blank sheet of paper would look like and how ridiculous the point you're at is.
Mm-hmm.
And so at that point in time, you just recommend to just go back a step and say, just write your best team on a piece of paper, knowing what you know today, and let's start the conversation there.
Yeah.
Because this whole rejigging for different purposes is...
I know.
Is kind of mind-blowing to me.
Yep. And, you know, they've done a lot of good things, but basically their one blind spot that they've had the whole way through is trying to find the replacement at the top of the order, and it's led to a whole lot of these other things that are head-scratchers along the way. And, I mean, as I constantly say, Teddy, I'd love to chat with someone about it. It's on the selection panel. They're welcome anytime, any platform. We're more than welcome.
I think you're a reasonable person to talk to. I know often media managers get scared of talking too much to journalists and broadcasters, but I haven't heard a view you put forward in the last 6 years we've been doing this podcast that isn't a reasonable view or a reasonable question to ask.
Yeah.
I think there's more chance of him opening the batting than him batting in the middle order.
Okay. Yep. I guarantee he won't bat number seven like they made Josh Inglis do. I know that for sure. He's either batting five or he's batting one. But it'll be an interesting watch as to what happens next on that front, and I'm sure we'll talk about it again on Monday, and we'll see what happens when Pat Cummins does the pre-test press conference on Tuesday, where they ordinarily announce the team. The other thing to note is that Jai Richardson is in the broader squad, so he has bowled 60 overs since the start of November. He's still on a workload management plan. He bowled 26 overs in the match recently against the England Lions and picked up 4 for 35 in the first inning. So he's in and around the group as he continues his recovery from shoulder surgery last January, almost 12 months ago.
What wasn't clear to me, and maybe it's clear to you, is he in the squad or is he just around the group?
I think more the latter.
Is he available for selection?
I think more the latter. Hey, that they almost picked a guy in Brisbane that wasn't part of the squad. So who was on workload management plans and on over restrictions. So
it's a good point. That bloke happens to be the best bowler in the world. So
yeah,
and where I'm going is probably what you haven't joined the dots for.
Mm-hmm.
The Perth Scorchers play the Sydney Sixers on Saturday night. We'll get to the Big Bash. So now to manage his workloads, potentially not to play in the series, one of your biggest and brightest stars for your Big Bash is no longer available.
Mm. Yep.
Maybe he'll go back and play the Big Bash, but I find that very doubtful given his injury record that on Wednesday he'll be there and then he'll fly into Perth for Saturday. I don't know. What do you think?
I don't think he'll play in the Big Bash. I think they want him around the group. He'll continue to do his rehab there. I think he's only really bowled with a red ball, hasn't he, since making his return. I don't think maybe he played a one-day domestic game at the start, but I don't think...
So you're happy with that as a general course of action?
No. I would rather to see him, like as a cricket fan, I want to see him bowl in the Big Bash. Like I like watching Jai Richardson play. But I think if they feel like there's a live possibility he plays in either Melbourne or Sydney, and given how close these test matches are back to back to back, all of that you'd think's in play, that the bowlers have injury concerns already, maybe they think that's the better course of action for him to keep bowling in the nets.
My mind is so far away from how they're thinking about the construct of this team. Jai Richardson playing in Melbourne or Sydney on the back of two first-class games and a little bit of workload management.
Mm-hmm.
Is he that good a bowler that you jettison him into a test series?
Do you think he's closer to playing a test match this summer than Brendan Doggett?
Oh.
So I would...
I mean, that blows...
I would argue yes. But that's
again, blows my mind, though. The guy who's just played two test matches.
Correct. But he's also the guy that was on a bumper plan and which doesn't ordinarily bode well, I must admit, when the captain comes to you and says, hey, by the way, we're going to set a legside field. Here's a 4-5 field and just bowl it halfway down the track in at the ribcage. Like, that doesn't really scream, hey, you're the next star of Australian cricket and you're going to be the fast bowler going forward. When I saw that, my heart broke for Brendan Doggett. I thought, oh, boy, that the captain's basically come to you and said, this is what we want you to do. So, I don't know. It stinks to me. Like, they've gone, hey, we might need some more bowlers. Jai, what are you doing? How about you come be around the part of our camp? Because we don't feel like the guys that we got in and around the group are going to be up to snuff by the time we get to Melbourne and Sydney. You're on, you know, flatter pitches than what was presented up in Brisbane.
It's interesting conversation. I didn't think we'd get this far down. But you've actually made my mind kind of tick a little bit.
Yeah. Are we going to talk about the to and froms, what they're up to? They obviously went to Noosa, obviously to have a little bit of a getaway. And I think the interesting question around this group is, are they trending? And you sort of alluded to this when we spoke on Monday about, can they start in Adelaide with the aggression that they ended with in Brisbane? I was probably more in the camp that, yeah, what was all that worth? And interestingly, Tim Payne, one of your former teammates, basically came out and said, hey, Adelaide Oval suits them perfectly. Out of any of the venues, this is the ground that's, you know, going to suit the Baz Ball style approach. We know Mark Wood's out. He's on the way home with a left knee complaint. And Surrey seamer Matthew Fisher is into the group. He's played one test previously, which was in the West Indies, and that was way back in 2022. He's coming off a good county season where he took 31 wickets in 11 matches, but he's also
a good county season? 31 wickets in 11 matches. I'm going to say that's hardly doing your job.
He's also coming off a tour game where he bowled none for 105 at AB Field recently.
I mean, it's on brand because I saw this little table that talked through first-class overs bowled before the test series started, you know, the conversation of how underdone are they, this bowling attack. And I think it was like three, and none of them were from the fast bowlers since August, and the Australians were at 230 in the last test or whatever that was. So matched hardened Australian fast bowlers versus turning up straight from Sales Restaurant and a couple of scooies up at Noosa and a few net sessions here or there to go and play test cricket. So my concern for the English team is where their 20 wickets come from. We talked before the series of how Wood and Jofra Archer might be interchanged over time, and that means you get one nasty fasty in every test. I don't understand why, unless there's some injury concern, why Josh Tung isn't bowling. We've seen him in test cricket right through that Indian series. He is a wicket taker. Maybe he's a back of a length bowler, but you'd actually back him to find a way. Bowls a good pace. Feels like he's got a good heart to him and a good engine. Because we're not seeing much of that from the others, actually. And so maybe Archer turns up and has a real dip. Don't know. Who knows? That feels toss of the coin. There's a chance he doesn't play. And if I was the coach and captain, you'd be thinking about that. I don't think they get there. Maybe I was a bit emotional on Monday suggesting that. But you'd want to be kicking him up the arse and saying, mate, this test match, this series actually relies on you pulling your finger out.
Yeah. What about if Tung and Potts both play? So how about this for a proposal where essentially you say, let's keep one of the three from Brisbane. So you make your decision whether it's probably not going to be Cast, whether it's Atkinson or Archer that sticks around. Bashir comes in and you basically just say, let's throw a different look at him. Like to the point that whatever we've done so far is not really working. They might make the counterpoint the other way. Hey, we're essentially in a position to take, we got wickets hurried in a quick way in Perth. We didn't go so well in the second innings, clearly, when Travis Head blew them apart. And really, they should have taken more wickets than what they did if it wasn't for their poor fielding. But maybe you just give them a completely different look. And you say, right, here's Bashir, here's Tung, here's Potts, here's some guys that you haven't been able to line up so far. And then give you maybe Archer's the balance there, someone else that plays with them. And almost turn the attack over and just go, let's go with something different. And if it doesn't work, well, the series is over, but this is our last chance to really throw something different to try and keep it alive. And knowing that these three test matches are back to back to back, and you're probably going to need the whole room at some stage across the next 3 weeks anyway.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think there's one to come in and a decision around the spinner and how that interacts. And I think they have to play Bashir and how that kind of plays through for the batting order as well, because they'll be taking one less bowler, essentially. and Stokes does more bowling.
Okay.
Well, Jack's the batter, right? So if Bashir comes in and they want to keep Will Jacks instead of Pope, they're playing one less bowler.
Yeah, I think Pope plays. Yeah. I think there's a.
Now we've got 12 people. So you're saying that Jacks misses out as the spinner?
No, I think there's a world Pope plays and Smith doesn't. That they could play Pope and he keeps and goes down to seven. Like he's shown more with the bat this series than what Jamie Smith was. Remembering, he didn't have a good test in Brisbane, but he was their most organised bat in Perth. But Jamie Smith, with all due respect, like he's looked like this is a baptism of fire for him. Like where it's all of a sudden like he's sort of got blown out in really both test matches so far. So I don't know. I mean, England have done funky things in the past. I could absolutely see a world where they do that.
That wasn't on my bingo card.
Yeah. How does it sound?
Maybe it's the reason why they do it. Don't know. That would be left field. And Ollie Pope bats at three or six?
Maybe down the order. Yeah, he probably wouldn't bat at three if he's keeping. Will Jacks, I think the last test Jacks played, Pope kept, and Jacks even batted at three, I think, in one of the innings over in Pakistan, previous to Brisbane, of course. Andrew Miller, the Crick Info editor in the UK, I don't know if you saw his quote basically saying, hey, if it's time to throw something different at them, wheel out Johnny Bairstow, bring him back, chuck him in there. If there's something that's going to unsettle the Australians, he was quoted as saying, England need passion, England need fight, England need someone who's going to be furious at the state of the world. And who else than the guy who hasn't played a test since the tour of India in early 2024? What do you reckon about wheeling out Johnny Bairstow and getting him on a London flight direct straight to Oz?
The problem with having such a big gap between test matches and having travelling journalists is they need to file every day, generally speaking. And so they come up with these ridiculous suggestions to fill in paper space.
Yeah. Not a fan?
No, I'd personally prefer them to call Sam Billings. Well, not personally, because you want the Thunder to do well. Sam Billings would be better off playing than Johnny Bairstow.
We'll get to the BBL in just a moment. We've got a whole lot still to chop up, and my time management's not always my strong suit, which Ben Cameron tells me all the time. Mitch Marsh, who we spoke about on Monday fleetingly about his Red Bull prospects, all of a sudden it was reported that, hey, Mitch Marsh is actually retiring and there's every chance he's played his last first-class match for Western Australia. But as the statement read on Monday night, he's still open to the prospect of playing Test cricket. Now, he has spoken to ABC Sport for Summer Grandstand this weekend and Aaron Bryans and gave this little insight, Teddy, as to how it all went down.
Obviously, I was very keen for it to go under the radar and not make any fuss of it, but it somehow got out there. So here we are. But I'm all good. Had a great time playing for Western Australia. Now just looking forward to focusing on the Big Bash.
How did you react when the news dropped on Monday? Was it a little bit of a shock to the system that, suddenly it was a public narrative?
I was a little bit disappointed, I must be honest. But that's the world we live in these days. So, it was obviously eventually going to come out at some stage. And as I said earlier, I was really keen for it to go under the radar and just walk away quietly. But that's the way it goes sometimes. Now, as I said, just looking forward to, the Big Bash.
He's played six games, Teddy, in 6.5 seasons for Western Australia, which I couldn't believe it was so few. But obviously he's played a fair bit of test cricket during that particular time. But he's done. We won't see him again for WA, given the crowded white ball schedule early in the new year.
So just give me some more context here. He's still available for test cricket. Is that self-appointed availability?
I think he's basically like, hey, if they want me to come play for Australia, sure. But
well, me too. I retired from first class cricket in 2018, but if they still
maybe you shouldn't have.
Batter, maybe I should.
You should have left yourself available.
Still available. And what was he expecting? Was this always? I'm just confused as to he told the team but didn't expect it to get out.
Yeah.
This was always the plan at the start of the season that he'd only play half a season or be available for half a season. That was confusing to me.
What's even more confusing is why did he play that one game? So, like, if he wasn't, and he says that people, it's part of the interview, he goes on to talk about how people close to me knew for a while that this was going to be my last Red Bull season. I'm just fascinated as to why that one game. Was it because the team wanted him? Was it because the selectors wanted him to play? Was it because he wanted to play? Like, if he wasn't planning to play long-term or going forward, what was to what end?
I think this is a mystery.
Yeah.
Maybe you could invite the selectors on.
Oh, I have.
To National Grandstand on the Saturday, and you could pose the question politely to them.
Yep. Open open invitation. I don't really think we got much more to say about that, do we? I don't know what the segue was. I think that sort of just stands. If you want to hear the full interview, Aaron Bryans will have Mitch Marsh on this weekend on Summer Grandstand. Is it BBL time, or do you want to do some other quick hits first?
I think the BBL starts on Saturday. We've got to prioritise
Sunday.
You know, the next big thing.
Yep. So WBBL ends Saturday. Men's Big Bash starts Sunday. So it's going to be the Scorchers and the Sixers to kick it off. The two most successful franchises in the history of the BBL. Other key dates to look out for on the calendar. The grand final rematch. Hurricanes play the Thunder December 16. We've got the Melbourne Derby at the MCG on January 4, and then on the 10th it'll be the return clash at Docklands. The Sydney Derby, the two matches, December 20 is the first one out west, and then at the SCG on 16 January. The New Year's Eve clash is going to pit the Strikers up against the Heat, and then the Boxing Day doubleheader sees the Sixers and the Scorchers both host fixtures. Now, I sent you last night, Teddy, a little sort of bulletin board of little quick questions, which I've spoken to people close to this, and I understand that the creative team, their preview questions that they put forward weren't actually well received from the Cowan administration. What on earth has happened here? I just had the winner, runner-up, wooden spoon, leading run score, all your key questions. You didn't go for it.
I mean, I gave a little bit of thought, but then halfway through when I was thinking about it,
yes,
I thought, this is the discerning person's cricket podcast.
Yep.
Do you agree with that?
Yeah.
So all our listeners know that most runs is essentially confined to the opening batters, full yep. stop. You'll know, history would suggest if you don't open the batting, you're not going to most runs. So it's a pretty vanilla question. Why don't we think about actually...
It's just a way into the conversation. Then we can extrapolate from there.
Yeah, okay. Well, I'm going to throw a couple of questions back. Who's going to hit the most boundaries?
Right. Mitch Marsh.
Who's going to hit the most sixes?
Yep.
Like something that actually impacts the game more than the 16 players that have the privilege of opening the batting.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. Same with who's going to bowl the most dot balls, most wickets. Well, the person probably who bowls at the right time to certain players in different lines. It's kind of irrelevant in 20 overs who takes the most wickets and who scores the most runs. It helps.
Okay.
But should that be the defining narrative that we debate?
Sure. Yep, I'm happy to take a different lens on that, for sure.
That was my only... I mean, more broadly,
mm-hmm.
T20 cricket is probably the hardest format to predict, and so all my predictions come with the caveat of most of these have been thought through, but I actually have no idea. So if you're looking for some kind of expert insight... Mm.
But what we like to do is we like to chop them up and then we'll write them down, put it on socials, and then we'll hold you to it. So later,
and then
in the time,
when I win the bet, you take me to dinner. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Or we can say, hey, Teddy, you're miles off. You're nowhere near it.
Yeah. Okay. So, I got it.
So with all of that said, as an introduction, I know people are thinking, this is why I want to hear it, because Teddy's so excited for it. Who's going to win the Big Bash this year, Teddy?
I think the Sydney Thunder will win the Big Bash this year. I love their list. I love... You know, the tactical ability of Warner as the captain is high. They've got some great leaders in Green, Billings, very experienced captains in their own right who can support Warner as a lieutenant. I think they've recruited well. I think they've got great young talent. People like Sammy Kay, who probably we didn't necessarily think was going to play a whole season, is going to play a whole season.
Mm-hmm.
So they've got all their bases covered. The only thing on my mind is the quality of the wicket and how they can perform at NG Stadium, but I'm assured that that's going to be well looked after. And I look through that list, and I look through the other list, and I think they should win it.
I had the Thunder as my runner-up, so I think we're on a similar wavelength there. And I've gone very boring for my winner.
Scorchers.
Yeah, it's pretty hard to overlook. I mean, they do it so often, and they got Mitch Marsh for the whole tournament. When was the last time he played a whole tournament? We're skipping straight to the bold prediction. Who's your runner-up quickly?
Well, I'll come there. Why it's a bold prediction? I think the Scorchers might get the spoon.
What?
I mean, it's a bold prediction. You wanted a bold prediction. I look through their list and I think they're all teetering over the edge of their peak performance.
Jeez.
Yes, they're well cut, but you know, there's. when you look at Western Australian cricket, they yep. tend to come hand in hand. So the Scorchers and the state domestic team
mm-hmm.
kind of perform, you know, in lockstep. They've been absolutely woeful in other formats of the game. And so that must translate a little bit. The international players aren't superstars, so I'm kind of putting all these algorithms in. They have some home ground advantage. I get it. They're going to be world supported. I'm probably going to be totally wrong, but you want a bold yep. prediction? I think they finish last.
That is bold. And yeah, I think, well, there we go. So you think they finish last? I think they're going to win it. My wooden spooners are the Adelaide Strikers.
They're finishing second last.
Yeah, I'm a little worried for them and for Tim Payne. So obviously the backdrop to all of this is the fact that the South Australian domestic team just won the Sheffield Shield. Payne takes over from the Strikers. They didn't have a great campaign last year. They're paying a lot of money to Chris Lynn, so they'll rise and fall with basically how he goes, and he's going to need a high output at an advanced age for them to, you know, get bang for their buck. And then you've got someone like Travis Head, who's not going to play really at all. Alex Carey will play, you think, towards the back end, but at that stage, are they still live in the tournament? So I have a few concerns about the Adelaide Strikers, so they're my wooden spooner.
So my runners-up while
yep.
while we're here, and this is a bit of a sleeper team, and where my predictions go pear-shaped, they also play on an absolute tip of a wicket. I think the Renegades list and how they've reformulated that team looks pretty strong. And if they can put it together, I feel like a Thunder Renegades
wow.
final could well be on the cards.
The two little brothers in the big cities. The BBL organisers would love that. And Cricket Australia, no doubt, if they get some action out of the Sydney and Melbourne teams. So you take the question however you want. I'll say leading run scorer, but you can say guy who hits the most sixes or whatever it turns out to be. Mm-hmm. Most impactful batsman, whatever it is. I'm going very boring again here. If I pick the Scorchers to win it, Mitch Marsh is going to play every game. He's going to bat up the top. Hard to go past.
Okay. Let's really go crazy. Mitch Owen.
Leading run scorer.
Well, like he was last year. Like he hit twice as many boundaries, I think, as the next batter in the competition.
Yep.
Between sixes and fours. If plays on a great wicket on a small ground in place that he targets, I think you get pretty short odds on that.
Yep. I'm a little worried about Mitch Owen this summer. I think that I wonder...
What takes you there? Pressure?
Yeah. Following up. Just whether it's he's had a few injury concerns leading in, hasn't had the quite sort of fluent run. They're trying to make him into this sort of lower middle order player in the national team. I don't know. I wonder if I wouldn't be expecting him to have the same campaign he had last year. Leading wicket taker / most dynamic, most impactful, most dot balls, interesting bowler in the tournament.
You're good. You are good, honestly.
Mine overlaps a little bit here with my overseas player who I've got here on top, and keeping with our Thunder love, often the best international player or overseas player is not usually your high profile name brand guy. It's not, you know, Babar Azam or Shaheen Shah Afridi or whatever it turns out to be. Shadab Khan. So a guy that can bowl some leggies, some bat in the middle order, is going to play, no disrespect, and I know you have great optimism, but he's probably going to play on one of the worst pitches in the country. It's going to be hard to try and do much with him. I think he has a chance to really dominate this tournament, so I'm going Shadab Khan as my leading wicket taker and my best overseas player.
So he's a toss-up between Shaheen and Shadab. For me, for best overseas player, my leading wicket taker / most impactful / most interesting bowler / person who probably won't bowl the most dot balls but will yep. win games is Tanvir Sanger.
Okay. I like it.
So you and I, they play for the same team.
Are they going to play together?
100% they're playing together.
Yep.
I actually think if Ashwin was playing for the Thunder, all three of them would play.
All three of them. My bold prediction, just to tie a bow on this, this is a little tongue-in-cheek. And I could have tossed up Jamie Overton or Rahan Ahmed, but you get the thinking of where I'm going here. I'll say Rahan Ahmed. Rahan Ahmed leaves Hobart suddenly in January to join England Test Squad as shock call-up at the end of the series to try and avoid whitewash defeat. and it sort of follows in the path of your Scott Borthwicks and your Mason Cranes and these
Sam There's a Billings. Name this podcast doesn't talk enough about.
And these guys that randomly just bob up that happen to be in Australia, and all of a sudden, oh, we need him. He's going to come and try and save the day for England and try and get a test at the end of the series. So that's my bold prediction, which, as you
is
said,
that is a Big Bash prediction or is that Nash's prediction?
Well, it's a guy, the guy that comes out of the Big Bash that's it sort of ties the two competitions together.
I think it's a fun conversation. This is a total segue, but a few of my English friends have, at the start of the series, sent their England 11 for the Sydney Test match and what it looked like. And, yeah, there were three
Ollie current, Robinson in it. And
yeah, I mean, there were three current players in that lineup. People were coming from all over. So what was the question?
You've already done yours. Bold prediction. So you said about the Scorchers.
Yeah. What about you asked for breakout?
I was going to say, this is the last category. And this is a fun one because we have done this, haven't we, ourselves in recent years. And we love chucking up some breakout players. What's the criteria?
Below a certain number of Big Bash games, has played for Australia. Hasn't played for Australia.
He's got to pass the Corbin test. Otherwise, I'll jump in and say no, doesn't count. But give me a name.
So if I threw Sam Constance at you, you'd say,
well, I mean, he could really, if he has a breakout tournament, he could go from being a guy that we're looking at in test contention to all of a sudden play, oh, maybe he's got a white ball future for Australia. So I can see where you're going. Is that kind of what you mean?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think he's on the cusp. He's in terms of, does he qualify? But if he does qualify, I'd probably throw that name at you. The other name I'd probably throw at you is Marley Beardman.
Yes. For the Wooden Spooners. So he'll bowl some thunderbolts. He can crank them up there.
Well, that's where usually these breakout situations come from, speed where people have, and you catch people off guard, whether it's, you know, Henry Thornton or Johnson, or, you know, like someone who people get the first time they face them, they're like, oh, goodness me, that's 2 yards quicker than I expected and my stumps are missing.
I like it. No, I'm going to put you down for K-Gun and Marley Beardman. My one is Harry Dixon, who is the Sprout guy in Victorian cricket. People love him. I know Adam Crosthwaite talks about him all the time. I think he plays for St Kilda, but Sean Marsh type comparisons, like left-hander, beautiful stroke player.
Pure.
Yeah, I hope he gets a run at it, and I hope he bats towards the top. None of this, come in at six or whatever. Let's get him up there and throw his hands at a few. The other one too is, it's sort of more in UK gun type sort of category, who a guy we know about but hasn't really done it in this format of the game. Liam Scott, who has only played 9 BBL games. I thought he'd played much more than that. And I know in those top end series he'd gone up there, and I think the year before last he was player of the match in the final. But I think he'll get a better run at it. And a guy that can both bat and bowl. I wouldn't be surprised in a team that's going to be looking for a few stars whether Liam Scott can be one of those for the Strikers. A couple of other talking points before we get into it. So,
that you've got a 26-year-old breakout player. That's good.
He can break out at any time. Hey, Josh Brown broke out later in life, and now he's earning big bucks playing for the Melbourne Renegades. And
I don't think he is anymore. I think they've worked out that.
I think Stingy's still on the contract. Whether he's playing as much cricket or not, it's another thing. What about your man Mozzie, Moses Enriquez, who said batters should be penalised 1 run if they leave their crease early, talking about possible little rule tweaks in BBL. You're a fan of it.
I mean, generally, just as a point, if Moses speaks, we should be listening. He talks sense.
Yeah.
Very rarely do you, anything comes out of his mouth, and I think, no, that's ridiculous.
You guys have a lot of reverence for him in New South Wales cricket. Bubba Azam, I love that Bubba's here. I sent you some beautiful photos of him walking
out. Gorgeous, with the backdrop of the ladies' stand, the sunset over the city, Bubba in the magenta.
Proper international superstar wearing a Big Bash uniform, and it happened to be that beautiful magenta as well. What I hated is when he turned around, started to walk off, and I was like, what is that ugly thing on the back of his shirt? He's wearing triple digits. First one of them, 0. He's wearing 056 because there's already a 56 at the Sydney Sixers, which is Mitchell Starc, and nobody was able to have a calm, clear conversation with the pair of them to say, hey, Bubba really wants to wear it. Mitch, you're probably not going to play a game anyway. Would you care if Bubba wears it? And if you play, we'll worry about it down the track. How on earth is he wearing 056 and someone else is wearing 50? What's happening there in New South Wales, Teddy? Sort it out.
This happened with someone else where they chose a 3-digit number recently as well.
Disgusting.
I can't remember. I'll come back to you. I mean, I don't sit in the stands and I go, oh, What number's that? Who is it? Like Mitch Stark and Bubba Azam?
Yeah.
Let them both wear 56 if they both want it. What's the purpose?
Yeah, well, I think it's to help identify the players. So,
but mate, one's six foot seven and bowls left arm rockets, and the other is 5 foot nine and a half and strokes them around. Like, there ain't going to be much confusion.
Do you know what?
Between Bubba Azam and Mitch Stark. They're not twins.
Whatever the answer is not put a zero in front of it. So that I guarantee you people will notice that. The little kids will be like, Dad, why has that guy got zero in front of his number or whatever, and he's wearing this huge thing across the back, and what should have been a beautiful look is going to be ruined by a three-figure digit on the back of Bubba Azam. Just a couple of quick players. How are we planning on, what are we expecting from them? So I had Mitch Owen down, but we've sort of covered that. Jake Fraser-McGurk. Trending up, trending down. What are we expecting this year?
Down.
Oh, needs a big tournament, doesn't he? It's a fascinating stage for him. I know he's got a reserve on him in the IPL auction and everything else. And Glenn Maxwell, who's really going to play the whole tournament, he's a fascinating watch. So he's taken himself out of the IPL pool. He played for Fitzroy Doncaster on the weekend, which I love seeing him in the maroon with the big lion on it and running around playing grade cricket, this superstar of world cricket. How's Maxie going to go?
I think he's going to be the player of the tournament.
Oh, okay. Big tournament for him.
Hard to bet against him. I mean, last year he was electric with the bat. And when he's focused and hungry, as he proved last Big Bash, to try and get the stars, drag them into some kind of contention for something, he's very dangerous. So if the people around him do half a job, I think Glenn Maxwell could shine or will shine.
I tend to agree with you. I think... And also, you got to remember, this is a guy that has basically played consistent franchise cricket for over a decade against the world's best players. And this is a step back in class for him, isn't it? Playing in the BBL against many guys that, even if he's in an advanced age, there's a lot of these guys that aren't on his level. And given how sharp he is as a cricketing mind, I'm with you. I think he's in for a big tournament. And hopefully, for the competition's sake, I think we need a competitive Melbourne Stars. We haven't had one for many years now, so... hopefully he can lead them on to good things. Tuesday night, Teddy. I know you've got this. You got an alarm and you got it in the calendar and everything else ready to go. 8 p.m. Australian Eastern Daylight Time, 16th December. IPL auction, the latest edition. 77 free spots. 30 can be filled by overseas players. There are 20 Australians that will go under the hammer. Cam Green's got the highest reserve on him of 339,000. He did go for 3.15 million, but interestingly, he's not expected to fetch that amount again. Now, the reason for that is these greedy IPL owners, sort of money hungry, have put a cap on the international players. Have you seen this? So there's a new cap now of just over 3 million Aussie dollars for overseas players. If there's a winning bid that exceeds that amount, the successful franchise will have to pay the excess towards the BCCI's player development program. So basically, if you're a player that goes for $4 million, you're only going to get 3 million of that, and the extra 900,000 is going to end up in the coffers of the BCCI. How convenient is that? That all of a sudden the world's best talent has got a cap on the earning potential is what they can walk away with. No such cap on the local players.
Wow, I didn't know that. Thanks for bringing that to my attention. I mean, the IPL generally undervalues their players and how the proceeds of the game are shared. We know that no managers are involved. There's no players' union over there. And as a portion of revenue that finds its way to the players is the lowest of any Tier 1 league.
Incredible, isn't it?
So
incredible.
They manage their cost base, I think they call it, pretty well. And this is... I mean, not an example of that because the money still needs to be paid, but how that gets distributed is interesting.
Mm. Other players nominated, Jake Fraser-McGurk, obviously after Delhi bought him for $1.65 million last year. He did fall out of that team. Steve Smith hasn't played in the IPL since 2021. He'll go around in the second set of batters, so they're in like basically reserve prices. The other names to look out for here, Cooper Conley's in it. Jai Richardson's in it, so he's back from shoulder surgery. Spencer Johnson hasn't played since last year's IPL. He's also in it. And Jason Berendorf in the mix as well. There's 20 names. You can find them online. I don't think anyone wants me to read out a big shopping list of names right here, right now, but that's on Tuesday night. So it's what we call a mini auction.
I'm going to be watching the Thunder play the Hurricanes.
Mm.
You can give me updated via text message. Thanks.
Do you know who will be watching it? So those 20 names, all the boys that are in it, they'll be keeping a close eye on it, no doubt about that.
Is it 3 million or is it 2.5?
Yeah. Jeez. Future tours program. So there's been sort of regular reporting of this. Dan Cherney on Code Sports talking about the fact that South Africa are unlikely to play a test here until late 2030. So they visit in the summer of 2030-31, but they won't be involved in the holiday period, obviously, given the SA20. So it looks like the next few summers going forward. So next summer's going to be New Zealand, as we know, and then they'll head away to India. They'll come back and play the anniversary test match, the 150 years game against England. Then it'll be 3 against Pakistan, 2 against Sri Lanka the following summer. Summer after that, 5 against India, 5 against England the summer after that. And then it gets to the South African tour, which is looking like 3 tests against South Africa, but they'll be gone by the holiday window. So then the West Indies are coming out to play the MCG and SCG test matches in the summer of 2030-31. And who knows what cricket looks like at that stage, Teddy. It feels like a long way away from where we sit here at the moment in 2025.
Yeah, I'm unsure the future tours program is worth the paper it's written on for the next 5 years. I think things are moving pretty quickly.
We'll see. Maybe we never get there to the West Indies test match of 2031 in Sydney. Ollie Peake's been named to lead Australia's title defence. He was the youngest member of the team that won the under-19s title the last World Cup in 2024. This will be played in Namibia and Zimbabwe. So they're co-hosts of the 2027 Cricket World Cup, the 50-over version, and they're going to host the under-19s here, which I don't mind as, you know, two nations get the opportunity, a little dress rehearsal.
It's a great idea. And there's a great new cricket ground in Namibia that we saw them beat South Africa in a T20 game. I didn't realise Ollie Peake was still under 19.
Amazing.
He's a gun. Having watched him bat a few times, I thought he was a little older than that. That's interesting.
So January 15 to February 6. So that's not too long away now. 16-team tournament. The Aussies are pooled with Ireland, Japan and Sri Lanka. So I'm pretty confident the Aussies will make it out of the group. Tim Nielsen's leading the way there.
You're pretty confident they're going to make it out of the group.
Something would have to go horribly wrong for that not to happen. I've got a couple of little questions before we get out of here. I feel like
who wins the women's big bash?
Yes. We haven't touched on that. Who wins the women's big bash? Hobart. I think we liked Hobart right at the start of the tournament. They've got an absolute squad together. Scorchers did well to win through last night. They got more cricket, Teddy, than I thought they were going to, given the forecast, but basically played the full fixture, and Alana King and Beth Mooney starred. Scorchers beat the Sixers last night, so final is Saturday night. You can hear it, of course, on ABC Radio and through the ABC Listen app. Who do you think? You on the Hurricanes or you on the Scorchers riding the wave of momentum?
Canes. Imagine playing whatever they call it, a qualifier in Perth, flying to Sydney, playing 2 days later, flying to Hobart to play 2 days. If Perth win this, they deserve every ounce of gold in the trophy.
Promised listener questions the other day, Teddy. Danny is complimenting Alex Carey on his wicket-keeping, which obviously we've sort of spoken about. He said he wanted to just jump in and say, hey, Alex Carey, hats off.
Good.
David says he's the coach of an under-14 side. If my captain had the body language of Ben Stokes, I'd pull him up straight away. Do you have an issue with England's body language?
No, I don't. Hasn't rung my bell, to be honest.
Tim, questioning on how the media have handled Nathan Lyon's omission, which was difficult to watch Lyon dragged into a TV interview. Why didn't Usman Khawaja have to face up the same way? From Tim.
Great question. Don't have an answer.
I would expect here that basically, they gave the guys the option if they wanted to speak. Usman essentially said, look, I'm cool. I don't have anything to say. And Nathan basically said, yeah, I'll do it. And that's generally...
Listen to this. So, I've got something to say. Turn your mics on. Yeah.
That's usually how these things work. That often the media manager would go to them or the comms team and say, hey, you've got a request from Channel 7 or from whatever. Do you want to do it? More often than not, the player will say yes. Certain scenarios, they'll say they don't want to do it. And I would imagine that's how that all came about. Simon says, loving the pod with Teddy. Hope you touch on the West Indies today. I think they've inspired more love for the game worldwide than the Bazballers after one courageous innings. Speaking about the highest fourth innings score that they were able to assemble here of chasing a target of 531. Justin Graves got the double 100. He was the seventh player in history to score a double 100 in the fourth innings of a match. Kemar Roach supported him, stayed at the crease for 282 minutes, 58 not out. And in the end, that they fell 74 runs short. They finished at 6 for 457. So 6 for 457 after over 160 overs. They already hold the record for the greatest ever chase, which was against the Aussies back in 2003. And it's actually the second largest total in the last innings of a match. The only one that was greater was a timeless test played back in 1939. So there was a mammoth score. And in the end, Teddy, it resulted in a draw.
Yeah, I mean, I watched a little bit of this. The wicket was tricky to start with and then got better and better and better. I think if they played a day six, they probably still would have been six down. Like, it was. You couldn't get out by the end.
Should they have gone for it? Should they have thrown the bat at it?
Well, they did. There was a little sniff there for a moment, and then they kind of reined it in, and I thought cricket was for the better for them blocking out a draw.
Oh, right. Okay. Yep. I mean,
they clearly went for it. They scored 460 runs, chasing 580. At some point in time, you don't give them that
advantage
and over. Back to
yeah.
them.
They went at two and a bit and over.
No, but at certain stage, what I'm saying yeah. is at certain stages, they were push and pulls into that. It wasn't two all the way through, and they ground their way to 460.
Yeah. Yep. They're on again at the moment, so there's another test match being played, and New Zealand have lost a bowler, so Blair Tickner dislocated his shoulder, so they're one down, but they did lead by 73 on the first innings. So
sub him out. Oh, no, that doesn't exist anymore.
No, not yet. Not yet. One last one, Teddy, if you've still got a little bit of enthusiasm for me on the back end here.
Oh, I'm waning, but yeah, give me one more.
I feel like I'm losing you. Nicholas Puran, did you see this?
No.
How on earth were you not watching the Desert Vipers and the MI Emirates in the IL T20 competition?
I believe I missed that fixture. No, I'll have to go back to my streaming service and watch the replay.
You'll like this. So Rashid Khan beats Max Holden on the outside. Now, Holden was 42 off 36 at this stage, and we're getting towards the back end of the innings, heading into the death overs. So he comes dancing down the track, misses it on the outside. Nicholas Puran takes the ball. Rashid Khan is wicketless at this particular stage. He would remain so because Puran turns down the stumping. Basically has him cold. Holden turns around, looks at him. Puran says, "Nah, we're happy with you here, mate." So he does not take the bails off. Gets better. Playing to miss the next ball, trying to play a slog sweep. The next ball retired out. So basically they yanked him. They said, "Yep, nah, that's enough. If you can't get out, we've seen enough." And then Shimron Hetmyer and Dan Lawrence come together. They put on 30 off the last 17 balls, and the Vipers end up winning by a run. So they won by one run, and in the end, they pulled a set batsman who Nicholas Puran refused to stump. Rashid Khan didn't end up with a wicket, and in the end, it was the right move. They retired a guy out, and ultimately, it won them the game.
I mean, wild story. Thanks for digging that up and sharing it. I mean, my mind instantly goes back to, we've just discussed who gets the most wickets in the Big Bash, as though that's some big thing, and it's just proven to be totally irrelevant. That's wild.
Yeah.
Actually, I mean, great piece of keeping. It was a waste of two balls, as it turned out. They should have yanked him as soon as the opposition do that. I reckon you'd probably retire him out anyway. Yeah. So they wasted a ball.
Maybe they got clued in on the back of that. They thought, hang on, we're getting played here.
Who's the patsy?
We're getting played. And
it would have been amazing if you could see that play out. So the next ball, goes, oh, okay, well, they don't want me out. I'm going to try and hit a six. They hit it straight up in the air, and everyone just stands with their hands in the pocket.
Let it hit the ground. Yeah. I mean, we've talked a lot, haven't we, about tactics and keeping certain batters on strike, but that's next level. Guys, 42 not out.
That is brilliant. Hey, yeah. I mean, experienced T20 camper. I wonder if they had discussed that previously as the overs went on or in a team meeting, because that is a total outlier in behaviour.
Yeah.
No player is probably, they might be thinking that, but they can't necessarily control it. Yeah. Imagine the ball did go up and the bloke under it just stood there.
Yeah.
And then the bowler blows up and the coach will be like, hang about, it's better for our team. There would need to be a concerted agreement that was going to be the case, sort of thought.
Amazing. I've never seen it in my time watching cricket, and maybe it's something we'll see a bit more. The wicketkeeper turning down at stumping.
I think you're probably right.
Teddy, that's a marathon hit out, and people will love it. People are thirsty for more and more cricket content at this time of the year, and that'll keep you going across the weekend. We'll be back on Monday. It's an hour-long drop off the ABC Cricket Podcast. I'll chat to you on the other side of the weekend.
Later, Corb. I need to sleep after that one. That was a marathon.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.